From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. Before we get to this episode's focus, I wanted to let our listeners know that this week the Office of Personnel Management, despite the government shutdown, released the premiums for the Postal Service Health Benefits Program plans participating in the upcoming open season. Generally, the average Postal Service Health Benefits Program premium increased slightly less than similar plans participating in the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. However, the average 2026 PSHBP plan premium still went up, on the average, by 11.3%. Naps Chat will be focusing on the open season on an upcoming episode of this podcast. In addition, last week, Postal Regulatory Commission Chairman Mike Cubillanda announced his departure from the panel. He made quite clear that leaving was voluntary, and he was considering the move for some time. The gavel now returns to Commissioner Robert Taub on an interim basis until either of three actions take place. One, President Trump designates Taub as the permanent chairman. Two, the president designates another commissioner as chairman. Or three, President Trump nominates and the Senate confirms a new commissioner who then the president designates as chairman. Taub previously served as the Postal Regulatory Commission chairman a number of years ago. Unlike other regulatory panels, the Postal Regulatory Commission has operated by consensus rather than along partisan lines. Now let's turn to this week's topic on Naps Chat. In late September, the United States Postal Service Office of Inspector General published a white paper regarding the evolution of the retail network of the United States Postal Service. As the paper points out, the expansive nationwide communications and logistics network includes post offices, postal stations, and branches, as well as contracted postal units, also known as CPUs. Over the 250-year history of our national postal system, the network has undergone periods of expansion and, for more than a century, has undergone prolonged contraction. There are presently approximately 33,000 retail locations around the country, generating about $9.3 billion in revenue. These retail units are in big cities, suburban enclaves, as well as rural outposts, and are the foundation of the Postal Service's universal service obligation. However, the nature and viability of the universal service obligation, as we know it, is coming under scrutiny by the Postal Regulatory Commission, Congress, and the Postal Service itself. The Office of Inspector General's white paper is key to this discussion. With me today to discuss the white paper on the post office network are Joy Sanzone, who is the acting research manager at the Office of Inspector General, and David New, a research analyst also at the Office of the Inspector General. Joy was our guest about 2 years ago when she discussed the Inspector General's work on the pension investment. So, Joy, thank you for returning, and welcome to Naps Chat, David, for joining us over today on an issue that is near and dear to my heart, that is post offices. As I mentioned in my introduction, the universal service obligation has been a mainstay in the Postal Service. Could you describe what the USO, the universal service obligation, actually is and why it exists?
Yeah, so I'm happy to take this first question here, Bob. The universal service obligation is essentially the legislation that governs the services that the Postal Service must provide to American citizens. So when you think about the obligation to deliver, you know, everywhere in the country, rain or shine, 6 days a week, that's part of the universal service obligation. And obviously, the universal service obligation exists to protect that for American consumers who rely on the Postal Service.
So the universal service obligation entails a lot of components. It is its accessibility, its frequency, and what it carries. How does this report play into that analysis or that obligation?
That's a great question. So, you know, as you mentioned in your introduction, there's 33,000 post offices in the U.S., and that's a bigger retail network than Starbucks, than McDonald's, than Dollar General, you know, other retailers with major domestic footprints. But, you know, those retailers don't have a universal service obligation. So we looked at, you know, post offices in the U.S., and, you know, one thing we observed was that in the U.S., there are no set criteria for the number of post offices, whereas other countries also have a universal service obligation. But the USOs in those countries tend to be much more defined. And specifically for the retail networks, they'll have a minimum number of locations defined, or, for example, how far they have to be from the customers they serve. And here in the U.S., we don't have any kind of criteria like that. There's no set number of post offices. There's nothing that dictates where they need to be. Just that the Postal Service has to provide universal service, but there's no clear definition of what that means.
Now, during the formative years of our republic, there was very limited residential mail delivery, if at all, or business mail delivery, if at all. And so you had post offices being the point of contact between the American public at that time and the Postal Service. As deliveries to homes and businesses progressed through the late 1800s, let's say, through today, how has that impacted the number of post offices and retail units?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that initially, for the first 100 or 125 years of postal service here in the U.S., post offices were the hub of doing any kind of postal business. So we went from 75 post offices in 1789 to, by 1900, we had 77,000 post offices, and that was really the peak of the network. And it was around that time that rural free delivery was rolling out. More and more people were getting delivery at home. And as that expanded to more and more customers, the number of post offices declined. So since 1900, we went from 77,000 post offices then to today about 33,000. So fewer than half the post offices that we had 125 years ago.
One of the things I've looked at is you have different types of retail facilities at the post, different points of access. You have independent post offices, you have stations, you have branches, you have contract postal units, and you might have, now we have online opportunities to purchase certain types of postal products. How do these different touch points impact the USO?
That's a great question and an unanswered question. So, you know, as you mentioned, there's this network of 33,000 post offices. There's also approved shippers that offer shipping products. There's USPS.com, which, you know, anyone can go to at any time of the day. The Postal Service also has a network of kiosks that are open 24 hours a day, expanding access that way. There's also Stamps to Go, which is, there's 60,000 locations at grocery stores and ATMs to purchase stamps across the country. And it's an open question how all of these additional points of access help fulfill the USO. As we mentioned earlier, there's no retail criteria here in the U.S., and that extends to these alternate access channels. They supplement the traditional retail network, but there's no clear answer on, you know, if I can go buy stamps at my local grocery store, does that help fulfill the USO? You know, and that's an open question and an important one, I think, for stakeholders to consider.
I just want to point a personal point of privilege here. Last week I had to mail something, and it required that I mail it registered. Mm-hmm. I cannot send registered mail through all points of access.
Right.
Do you think the USO does accommodate or should accommodate the ability to use special products of the Postal Service that might be needed, for which the Postal Service is probably the only entity that could offer it?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question to ask. And I think that's, you know, one of the reasons I think that there's really the potential to have more clear legislation governing this. And I think other countries have started looking at this and asking those questions. Whereas if you look at Germany, their Deutsche Post and DHL, they have decided that not collection boxes, but parcel lockers, like you would see, count as fulfilling the universal service obligation. And, you know, for some people that really, especially if you're living in a rural area, that may not be near as advantageous or convenient as having a full service post office. And that's why, you know, having clear guidance on these things is very important.
I should just say that for years, and I'm going to do a shout out to Robert Taub, who's now interim chairman, has been calling out for Congress to actually legislate what this universal service obligation is, because the PRC has to periodically evaluate and place a value on what is the value of a universal service obligation. But talking about the value and congressional interest in USO, as the paper points out, the white paper points out, every year the annual appropriations bill that reimburses the Postal Service for military and overseas voting and mail for the blind includes legislative language prohibiting the closure of small and rural post offices simply for not covering their cost. Could you talk about that provision and whether or not that really has an impact on postal finances?
Yeah, so this particular restriction came about in 1970 with the Postal Reorganization Act, which mandated that the Postal Service operate more like a business and be self-sustaining, but also said you can't close these rural small post offices just because they don't cover their costs. And that limitation remains in place today. And that's a very important consideration because today, the retail network overall generates a profit for the Postal Service. $9 billion in revenue to about $6 billion in costs in fiscal 20. But when we look at individual retail locations, more than half of them do not cover their costs. So the restriction on not being able to close a small office just because it doesn't cover their costs, you know, that applies to a number of post offices. You know, but one of the things we discuss in our paper, going back to the retail criteria that other countries have that we don't have, the Postal Service could establish other metrics to help assess performance of post offices. So even if it's not, you know, that they don't cover their costs, it could be volume, it could be distance to customers, it could be, you know, a set number of post offices or number of people served. There's many other potential metrics that they could be using to evaluate their network's performance and potentially optimize it.
One of the other interesting points in the white paper was the discussion about the potential misalignment of postal retail units. That is, post offices and retail units haven't really followed population growth. And in whether or not population or how population should define where a post office is located, I'm not sure about that because rural areas are very sparsely populated. Could you talk about that point?
Yeah, I think it's something very interesting to look at. And we have several maps in our paper, as well as an associated online story where you can view some of these maps in a bit more detail, where you do see that, especially in the more western areas of the country, that there are areas where really the post office coverage is not as high as it would be in a lot of areas, you know, in the Midwest and the East Coast that just historically have had, you know, much more coverage dating back to before the 1900s. And these areas that have seen, you know, significant population growth over the past decades, really the number of post offices in some of those areas has not really caught up to where people have moved across the country.
Yeah, that was an issue, I think, that was observed by the former chairman of the Postal Subcommittee, Steve Lynch of Massachusetts, about the number of post offices in the state of Massachusetts. He wasn't saying that they should close the post office of Massachusetts. He was just observing that how many they were in Massachusetts, let's say, as compared to, as you point out in your paper, Arizona, which is a tremendous, tremendous population growth, particularly over the last decade.
Yes.
I want to come back to something, to funding, a funding issue, because I think it's very interesting and it's overlooked. You mentioned in the paper, the OIG mentioned in the paper, that the current law actually establishes a public service subsidy to help maintain small rural post offices that don't make money. Mm-hmm. Yet the Postal Service has not requested that subsidy since 1982. Could you talk about the subsidy and how much money the Postal Service left on the table when it didn't ask for that money?
Sure. So this subsidy, it's $460 million a year. The Postal Service, it's available for the Postal Service to request. They would have to go through an appropriations process, but it is available for them to request. They haven't requested this since 1982. And this money, this amount, doesn't adjust for inflation. So, you know, $460 million doesn't go as far as it did in 1982. And at this point, that $460 million would not cover the estimated cost of providing all of these rural post offices. The PRC estimates it, I think, in the $700 million range. But, you know, $460 million is not nothing. So it would certainly contribute to defraying some of those costs of providing rural service. And while the amount itself doesn't adjust for inflation, we did look at how much they've left on the table since 1982, adjusting for inflation, and found that they've left on the table about $33 billion.
Let me repeat that. $33 billion adjusted for inflation was left on the table that could have been used to help offset the cost of post offices that exist in rural America that may not necessarily cover their costs. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about another item that you spoke about in the white paper was foot traffic in post offices, not necessarily revenue, but foot traffic. Could you talk a little bit about foot traffic and retail units?
Yeah, foot traffic, our paper focused really on the last 25 years and population trends and usage trends in the last 25 years. And foot traffic is down by about half during that time, signaling a tremendous shift in customer demand for mail and packages and demand for services offered at post office.
Let me follow up on that issue about foot traffic. As we were talking about, we have different postal retail units offering different types of services. Does foot traffic follow the services? For example, if I have a full service post office, did you detect any difference between the foot traffic and full service post offices in contrast to not, let's say, CPUs?
Yeah, we didn't measure foot traffic at alternate access channels. But we did look at revenue over the past few years for alternate access channels and saw that revenue is going down, just like revenue is going down at your traditional post offices.
Okay, so it didn't make that much of a difference. Now, an international experience on foot traffic, is that cross-cultural, cross-national, that foot traffic generally around the globe is going down?
Yeah, well, we don't have exact figures on it. It is something where we've seen mail volumes are down basically across the board, and in many cases, the Postal Service has done probably a better job of retaining some of that mail volume than other countries, which have seen a larger drop-off in their mailing services.
On your examination of postal units, you did, as we talked, let's stay on that foreign post issue. You looked at how foreign postal authorities redesigned their retail network. Could you talk a little bit about that experience, about redesigning its retail network?
Yeah. So when we look at foreign posts, a lot of them had a significant drop-off in their number of post offices, but that really occurred prior to the year 2000, and the number for most countries has been pretty stable since then. What we have seen in the past 10 to 15 years is a significant uptick in the number of parcel lockers, as well as parcel shops, which essentially are low service, not postal managed offices, but say just a pickup and drop off point, like within a local grocery store or convenience store. So these posts have really focused on expanding their parcel locker networks and their parcel shop networks to supplement their post office networks in the past decade or so.
So let me ask the final question, if I can. Is there something to learn from foreign posts? Or is this something, or is our postal experience so distinct from the foreign postal experience that really there is minimal education that could be sort of gleaned from that experience?
I think there is a lot that can be learned from these foreign posts. And again, obviously the Postal Service has a more expansive network and is dealing with more mail volume than a lot of these countries. But another thing that we've seen from other countries and we wanted to highlight a bit in the paper is especially we looked at this in France and in Italy, that they really see the value in a lot of their rural post office locations. And that's both on the postal side and the government side, because they've received subsidies to help provide additional social services based out of their post offices. A lot of post offices in France are basically hubs to connect to a variety of different government agencies, and you see a similar thing in Italy as well, where because of the appropriations they've received, they help connect people to these government services, and they're even offering things like co-working spaces and stuff to utilize their post office networks. So I think, you know, in some ways, obviously the Postal Service is unique in how much area it covers, but there are a lot of lessons that can be learned from other countries and how they use and adapt their networks.
And also, too, we didn't issue the Postal Service any formal recommendations for this paper, but what David said brings up a good point about the things we found are real opportunities for the Postal Service. We've talked a little bit about establishing criteria for the retail network, which is common in international posts. And to David's point about parcel shops, you know, we think there's an opportunity for the Postal Service to look more into additional alternate access channels, especially those that accommodate parcels. They are doing some of this at existing locations, so they're rolling out some smart lockers and some other parcel related services, you know, but the parcel shop model could be something to look into. And in addition, you know, the provision of more government services. Obviously, the Postal Service for a long time has worked with the State Department to do passports, you know, but there are opportunities to look into that as well, to better serve communities and to generate revenue.
In fact, the two most recent postal reform acts, the one in 2006 and the more recent one in 2022, envisions the Postal Service being in partnership with government agencies, but they really haven't explored that or maximized that opportunity.
Yes, it's certainly an opportunity for them to look into that more as a community service as well as a revenue generator.
Before I thank you, I just wanted to before I thank you for participating in NAPSJET, I wanted to just point out that earlier this week, the Office of Inspector General just issued a new white paper or audit on the financial history of the United States Postal Service, and that's my present reading assignment. I want to thank Joyce Anzone and David New of the Office of the Postal Inspector General for joining us on NAPSJET today. Thanks, Joy, and thanks, David.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you for having us.
And I want to thank NAPSJET listeners for logging on. Please share NAPSJET with your friends and colleagues, and in the meantime, stay safe and stay healthy.
And write myself a letter.